You coming?
It's just a place.
I don't know, it's just the kind of thing that people do. Don't you want to leave her flowers?
You go do what you need to do.
I did not come all the way out here to sit around with people who lost a man. I lost my wife. I belong here.
Up next, Jake.
I don't have anything to share.
Everyone has something to share.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Ramblecast. I am your host, Chris Cesarano, and this week I have a very special guest, one Richard Lovejoy.
Thanks for having me on. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, for some of my listeners that are from Gamers with Jobs, you'll know him as the Harpo Marxist on the forums. But for anyone else, you might know him from you have quite a career in acting, don't you?
I have a pretty strong background in theater, and I'm my film The Widowers is actually it's the first feature that I've written that's been produced. I've written several features before. This is the first one that actually has been shot and distributed. But I do have a pretty extensive theater background in New York City. I do a lot of actually gaming-based theater. That's sort of my other life.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about that, actually?
So in 2009, I wrote a play called Adventure Quest, which was done in the style of a classic Sierra Online adventure game, in that the protagonist of the play would walk around the stage picking up objects and trying to combine them to solve puzzles. He would approach other characters on stage, and instead of initiating in traditional dialogue, he would say things like, "Talk to man," or "Talk to woman." And then the other character, the NPC character, would have kind of a limited response, would have kind of their set response. So there was a whole play that was done in that style. I also did another play called Brain Explode, which was based more on text adventures and was actually interactive and involved six audience members, each having an allotted amount of time to give the protagonist commands, and the protagonist would interact with them directly, and they could converse. That was a really successful experiment, and I want to get back to doing plays that are like that, because I think audiences really responded well to it. And there's a lot of mileage, actually, in the combination of gaming and theater. I've seen some really cool stuff that I haven't been involved in. I saw somebody do do no theater via World of Warcraft once, and it was really cool because you get this extra element of there are other people who are there who are kind of watching this happen on the server. There's a lot of cool stuff you can do there, and a lot of my heart is in that realm for sure.
I know when a few of the other members of Gamers with Jobs first heard of Escape the Room, our first thoughts went to, there's a DS game called 9 Hours, 9 Persons, 9 Doors, where that kind of is the point of it, and it's a Vita PSP game, I believe. So I guess that's another way that we're starting to get some more interactive participatory things, I guess. But I also am reminded a little bit of back when I went to the Escapist Expo on its first year, they had a burlesque show, and one of the acts happened to have people come up and approach the burlesque dancer like a text adventure, and there were only select options they could choose.
And was that Nasty Canasta by any chance?
Oh, I don't. That does not sound like her name.
Because I know she had. I also do burlesque in the city from time to time. I haven't done it in a while because I've been completely in film land, and getting a film produced pretty much requires the surrender of all time, energy, and focus.
Yeah, I imagine.
But one of the best burlesque routines I ever saw was a text adventure routine that she did, and I'm wondering if this was the same one or if there's, I mean, it's a burlesque is a pretty nerdy scene. I think there's a lot of people who have all that kind of background and that kind of information to make a cool performance piece out of those materials.
Yeah, I've actually been kind of surprised because it seems like everywhere you go, there's like, and it's starting to happen at a lot of conventions too. Like a smaller convention in my area called Too Many Games, they ended up having a local-ish burlesque troupe come in with a bunch of video game acts, and it was like, okay, this is a thing now that's going to be happening. Which, yeah. You know, I'm not going to complain, but I just find it very interesting. So, yeah, having, in that regard, plays that kind of combine, you know, traditional theater with the interactive element. Like, do you basically essentially have people come up on stage, or is it like the audience votes, or in what way is it interactive?
With, I've actually done Escape the Room, and Escape the Room is fun, and it's kind of, it's cool in its own ways, and that's totally, it is totally incumbent upon that you go with a group of friends and it's you and your friends sort of trying to, it's mainly a locked door puzzle. Actually, it's you and your friends trying to piece these clues together,
but it's not really a story, so to speak, or a narrative.
It's not terribly narrative. The play that I did, Brain Explode, the premise of the play was that, it was set in the 80s, and there was kind of at the time when text adventure games were going by the wayside, and graphic adventure games were starting to come into being, and it's centered around this designer who is giving a conference trying to pitch his next text adventure and how he still thinks it's a viable medium, and he ends up getting hit with this blow dart that knocks him unconscious, and he wakes up and he's got a bomb in his brain that's going to go off in 60 minutes. So there are six people ahead in the audience who are pre-selected, and they each get 5 minutes on a mic in the first go, and then that's passed back. They get to pass it back in the other direction. So they will have up to 10 minutes. But for 5 minutes, they sit there and they can talk to him when he's ready to receive their commands. He'll make eye contact with them, look directly at them, and they can have a conversation. They can ask him about his past. They can tell him to do something on stage. They can give him a suggestion to how to interact with another character. But he retains some agency, and the actor who played the character did a tremendous job. His name is Stephen Heskett. And he would take every command, but he would put his own spin and attitude on it. And it became really interesting because there is the story of the character who's got this bomb in his brain, who is trying to figure out how to do that. And then there is also the theater between the players and the protagonist, their interaction as they kind of negotiate what's going to happen. And what I found was that people didn't troll it as much as you might think, because you're in a theater, there's a lot of people watching, and the players were, in a way, participants in the piece. Like, they were just as central character. When they had the microphone, they were just as central a character as anybody else on stage. And there's sort of this group pressure to make the experience enjoyable for everyone. So there was actually not a lot of trolling, though there was some really fun stuff where people would go off in weird directions and derail the play, but the play kind of was built to take that, if that makes sense. It was built to kind of be pliable in that way.
Well, it sounds like for your central character, at least, you also need someone that is very good at improvisation.
The three actors we had, Megan Melnick, Jesse Paul Wilson, and Stephen Heskett, were all really fantastic improvisers and very generous actors. I hope that people see a lot more of their work, because they were all just freaking great, and they made that piece really sing. That piece was structured with a number of kind of lily pads, I would call them. Which were pre-written scenes that were triggered when certain events happened or when certain types of commands happened. And they were specifically designed so that so that those actors could improv their way into them if they needed to. And that's how we sort of, that's kind of how we solved being able to keep the thing structured.
All right, and I imagine that you have a lot of plans, that, like, from your first time doing brain explode, and then, you know, now that you've done it and you've done a traditional film, you have a lot of ideas for what you might want to do on your next take at it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I love the theater, but I am definitely trying to figure out my next film choices and how to build off of The Widowers, which is something that I've put 10 years of time into at this point. It took me about 5 years to write it, and it took us about 5 years to figure out how to shoot it, edit it, and get it out into the world.
Now, that's an awful long time to be writing a single script. Where did you first get the idea for this film, if you don't mind me asking?
I don't mind at all. So the film, for anyone who hasn't heard it, is a comedy about grief, and it is about two childhood friends who lose their wives in a car accident, and they a 10-day therapeutic retreat for young widowers that's run by this woman who hasn't quite dealt with her own issues surrounding her own loss. The idea for me, I think the very earliest impulse for the idea was seeing how my mom reacted to the death of her father. My grandfather died very suddenly and very young. He had a brain aneurysm. And I remember as a child seeing adults not quite know how to approach my mother and deal with her grief over losing her father. Like she became this kind of strange alien being to everybody, even though death is a part of life and it's something that happens to everyone. And these adults presumably would have experienced something similar before. I think most people have experienced loss. I mean, it just becomes an inevitability at some point. And yet, culturally, we're not really equipped to deal with it well. People kind of don't know how to approach it. And there's a very strong focus on having the bereaved person move on or heal, even though that's not really what happens with loss. Like, there's no like heal. It's just such a crazy idea because it's a permanent change. So the loss is a permanent interruption of, you know, there's no recovering from that. So there's this weird thing that's a universal experience that everybody tiptoes around. And that's kind of where the impulse for the script came in.
It's very interesting because especially when you word it that way, it's kind of interesting how similarly people take, you know, heartbreak from something like death versus even heartbreak from just, you know, the end of a relationship, like being rejected or just getting broken up with. Like, the general response from people is, you know, there's a period of comforting and then there's a period of, okay, it's time to move on. And there is an awkward phase. And it's funny because last summer I had to watch someone go through a rejection, and there is that weird, you know, okay, how do I address certain things now with this person without making them feel worse, kind of a thing? Or, you know, is there a time to say, you know, like, okay, look, it's time for you to just get over it, kind of a thing?
And that's the thing, that sort of thing I think makes more sense with romantic kind of loss than it does with death, because a romantic loss is not the end of anybody's story. Death is a permanent and much more powerful change. I mean, that's a complete upending, and especially if it's somebody who's as, you know, as close as a spouse or a sibling or a parent before their time. And it's strange to me that you know what the funny thing is you do, you know, in a lot of ways, the way that we treat grief is a lot like the way that we treat romantic loss, even though that the scale of those two things are
very drastically different.
Yeah. So it doesn't make, it's, you know, it's, it's a kind of an insane thing in a lot of ways. And I definitely, there's a lot of that in the movie. There's the therapist character in the movie, Pam, does a whole lot of like cheering towards having the characters heal. Pam is basically somebody who's gone through a terrible loss herself. And rather than confront that loss, she decided that she would do everything in her power to help other people who are going through that loss. So that's kind of where her impulse comes from. But she very much in the film represents that kind of our current cultural reaction to grief and its problems and its flaws and how it doesn't really address the issue in a way that's healthy or productive.
And I think that was one of the things that I found more fascinating about the film, because you kind of start to pick up on it after a while, or at least I did, because very early on, the character that you played, wasn't it Jake, right?
Yeah.
Jake, he even brought that up, you know, all of our friends, you know, are telling us to just move on, and he's not happy with that response. And that's what you're finding, is this is supposed to be a location where everyone's understanding, everyone's, you know, everyone's lost a spouse, everyone's going through this grief in their own way, but the end result is let's get over it together rather than let's understand our feelings, let's understand what's going on, kind of a thing, and even just let that grief out. Because I imagine at some point too, and again my mind thinks back to like how we deal with romantic heartbreak, kind of a thing. Like, I mean, I imagine if you've ever been with a friend that's, you know, either lost a boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, like the relationship ended, like they were dumped or whatever, or they were just outright rejected, they're depressed for a while, that's all they kind of talk about. Actually, I'm kind of reminded of the movie Swingers too, with Jon Favreau,
right?
His character, you know, the same thing. Like, they make a joke about it where it's like, I didn't mention her once today, kind of a thing. And it's kind of this, and given the context of your film, it's kind of the same thing. It's you reach a point where you wonder, you know, are people going to get sick of you missing this person? When it's like, well, of course you're going to.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. It's an insane expectation, and it becomes, to me, it is compounded in its insanity by the fact that everybody's going to go through this. Nobody's not going to lose somebody. So it strikes me as really odd that culturally we haven't quite figured out the most compassionate and understanding ways to kind of engage each other with that. I would like to point, if anybody is actually going through such an experience, there is a wonderful website called Modern Loss, and they just have hosted a screening for our film prior to our distribution. And it's a site that's filled with some really great writing. They have great writers on that site who talk about grief in a really new and, I think, very productive way. And I would strongly encourage anyone who's interested in checking them out, whether or not you're actually going through that kind of experience. It's a great resource. It's a great resource for understanding what it's like to navigate that kind of loss. So I'm always curious as to what you, as somebody who watched the movie, not knowing what's going to happen, like what things stuck out for you, like what was funny, how did you deal with the tone? Cause it is a tonally, very intentionally a tonally unusual movie in the way that it blends straight up jokes with kind of these heavier, undercurrents. I'm curious, like, what your experience is watching that is like, and like where it affected you.
I don't know. At this stage, I kind of expect things to have tonal shifts based on mood, because that's kind of life. I mean, and that's even kind of my sense of humor. So having moments where you're watching your main character, Jake, do things that seem unusual, things that seem very serious, and then, like, the next minute your character, the guy that's always doing weed.
Oh, yeah, crack, actually.
Crack, oh, okay, there you go.
It's funny to me how many people mistake that for weed. Yeah, that's Gus, the heavy metal.
Gus, that's right, Gus. Gus, I really enjoyed Gus. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I didn't even know what drug he was doing. I grew up a mama's boy, so I don't know. But he always made me – he was always able to make me laugh for the most part. So, you know, you'll have serious stuff one moment, then you'll have him. And I think it's actually more powerful because he does have something serious towards the middle of the movie, I think. Like, one line of dialogue that – you kind of misinterpret because you're used to him being kind of spaced out, but then he's saying something, you know, very serious. And I think that's actually where a shifting tone is actually a good thing. So, I mean, to me, it worked very well because it made the humorous parts more humorous. And then the parts that were serious, like they stood out more. They're like, Oh wow. But I mean, it still takes skill to do that. You need to know when to throw the joke in there and then when to pull back and how much. Because the film never really felt too dark to me. Like, I guess technically I would kind of call it a dark comedy. But it's not really, because dark comedies usually have more violence and, you know, quote unquote, darker, grittier material. But I don't know. Like, it's not a drama. It's not a comedy. It's a dramedy. No. But it is. I mean, it's a movie. I mean, that's. I guess, like, it's one of those that I'm not exactly sure where I'll place it. Right. But I definitely did. I did really enjoy it, and I do plan on grabbing it on Blu-ray once I can.
Yeah.
Shill.
Yeah, we're hoping to have a Blu-ray special edition out on Amazon soon. Amazon kind of has a longer quality control process, so it takes a number of weeks to get up on that site. That's why that's the one platform we're not on. But we are on PlayStation, Xbox, iTunes, Google Play, and Vimeo. TheWidowers.com will have links to all of them.
And I did actually want to ask one more question before we got to the more spoilerific stuff.
Sure.
So, have you gone through something like this Grievers camp, I guess? I forget the specific name of it, but have you gone through something like that where it's just people trying to cope? Or did you have to do research into this, how this kind of thing? Because it doesn't look like it's a professionally done thing, a professionally done retreat. But
you're questioning Pam's professionalism.
But it still seems like something, like, it feels sincere. It feels genuine. It feels like something people would really try to put together.
There are retreats that are like this. These types of things do exist. I have never done group therapy personally, but I know plenty of people who have, and I have done a lot of research. I have also done conventional therapy, which you know, I'm comfortable admitting that I've done.
I think a lot of people these days have at some point. I know I did.
Yeah, it's a healthy thing to do. Actually, I think it tends to be a good choice to make, even if it ends up not being something which ultimately you continue doing. I think there's value in doing it.
And I should note, too, because I think there's a lot of people that feel that therapy is something you resort to when you have when you're suffering from something like depression or some other kind of mental illness, which, I mean, I'm not going to say, you know, you shouldn't consider those things when you have those issues. But, like, I know for me, when I went to therapy, it was just I was at a rough spot in my life where I was kind of my own worst enemy, too. So I did need a sort of third party unrelated to my social network to speak with, to vent, and to help direct me towards the path where I could acknowledge how much of it was my own doing and to get onto a more positive path. So I think that, I mean, you're right, like, therapy is something that, like, I think a lot of people try and tie it to some kind of illness, disorder, or just like if you're suffering from depression, bipolar disorder, or anything. I feel like a lot of people stress it in those situations, but if you're just at a point in your life where you're finding it rough to talk to people, that things are just, you need a way to stress and you need someone that's able to listen, therapy is, I mean, it's one of the things that it is really good for, and it can possibly help steer you on a good path.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I always think of it as you have a set amount of time with a completely neutral person who you could tell anything you wanted to, and you're free from judgment. You're not going to be judged in any way. And ideally, I think at its best, it functions as a good tool for you to vocalize and wrestle with whatever struggles you might be going through. In the case of the film, the type of, obviously it's a little bit critical of the idea of the way that we approach grief therapy in the kind of traditional model of grief therapy in the country, which is based on how do we make you heal? How do we make you, plug back into the real world where everything's going along and people are kind of hitting all their milestones and checking off the life to-do list of America.
It's like how to fix your broken self from grief. And you're not broken because you're grieving, kind of a thing.
Yeah, you're not. And you don't want to heal because whatever you're feeling, like, that's what you have of the other person. And that's not a negative thing.
Now, okay, I did lie before. I do actually have one more question before we do get into spoiler
sure.
territory. This was actually spurned a bit from the past weekend. Last weekend, I went and I saw Birdman in theaters because it's almost out of theaters and everything. I've been wanting to see it.
I haven't seen it yet, but go on.
You haven't seen it yet?
Yeah.
It's pretty good. I am not at all surprised that it won Best Film for various reasons. It is the perfect kind of thing to appeal to the Academy, I'll tell you that right now. But at the same time, a lot of the trailers and a lot of the, and I think even Birdman itself, were under Fox Searchlight, which, if I recall, Fox Searchlight is technically Fox's quote-unquote indie division. And a lot of the big studios have their quote-unquote indie divisions. And the thing is, though, all these films end up having big stars. And I remember one of the things you mentioned going from film festival to film festival is you have a truly independent film without any big names like that. That people, like, you don't have a recognizable name of an actor that's been in some blockbuster that everyone will have heard of. That you guys are just, so what was it like doing a truly independent film that doesn't have this kind of big studio distribution or backing? And I know, you guys found distribution, but I imagine it wasn't with the big studio. So how, like, what, like, did you even get to speak to those guys? Did they just not give you the time of day for reasons like you didn't have a big named actor?
Well, I will say, if I could do it all over again, because it is, the Charred Oak Films were all the four of us who composed Charred Oak Films, include Kent Meister, who plays Jonathan, Scott Chin, who directed the film, and Katie Irish, who was our producer, our costume designer. And we're all outsiders. And if we could do it again, I think finding a way to get named talent into the film would have made things a whole heck of a lot easier. And there are ways to do that even on our scale. It's just, it was one of our miscalculations, because when you're trying to make a movie and you're outside of the system, miscalculations will happen. It did present an extra challenge, and it does make me, in a strange way, the fact that we did get it distributed and out there is more of a win and more of an accomplishment, because we didn't have any sort of inside chance, and it still to this day actually continues to make it an uphill battle. Getting coverage for the movie, even now that it's released, is very difficult because we don't have a famous person in the movie. And it's from moment one of trying to get this thing out there, I'm not gonna lie, it's hard, and it's a lot of work, and I think more work than people realize. I have a day job that I go to that I'm very grateful for, that allowed me to even make this movie happen. But it's kind of like having another day job after that, where you have to, you know, put in your time. Like, I got to put in my time for the movie now, and that's going to be knocking on doors and sending queries and figuring out solutions for all these unexpected problems that pop up. I always felt like going into it initially, I felt like making a movie, you could kind of see, oh, I got to go from here, from point A to point B, and that's no problem. And then from point B to point C. But there are so many points between each point, and they just keep popping up. It's kind of endless, and it's kind of hard. I'm not going to lie, it's been not easy to do it that way. But we did. We got very lucky. I feel very fortunate. We managed to get a sales agent purely by luck. And our sales agent got us a deal again, because we pulled out the distributor that we ended up going with, I believe initially passed on us. And then we got a best narrative feature at the Chain NYC Film Festival. And they took another look at us and took us on board after that. So we got lucky in a lot of ways, and it's all about, you know, who you know and how lucky you are, really, at the end of the day. And you have to show up. Of course, your talent matters. You have to show up with something that's interesting, I think, and you have to show up with something that's fully formed. But yeah, I mean, it is luck. It's a lot of luck. And I feel very grateful for the fact that we got to where we did. I'm very proud of that.
Now, and you of course said you were looking into doing more feature films after this.
Yeah.
Do you think, because of that Chain New York City Film Festival award, and that you got distributed, that you have this movie out there and it has gotten some acknowledgement, you know, do you think things might be even a little bit easier with the next one, and you've been able to network, or are you looking at basically a similar uphill battle?
I mean, I think anytime you make a film is always going to be an uphill battle, particularly if it's an independent film. But there's no doubt in my mind that it's a lot easier, because a lot of the uphill battle was coming from the fact that everybody wants to make a film. If you go, I've never been to LA, but apparently you go into a coffee shop and everybody has Final Draft up on their laptop and has their screenplay and is trying to sell it. And it's something that a lot of people try to do. So the barrier for entry, there's a lot of people trying to do it and very few people who actually do it. So once you have done it, that is authenticity. We can now say, when we try to figure out how to raise funds for our next feature, we'll be able to say, look, we did this thing. and we'll be able to point to iTunes, and people will be able to go there and download it and look at the movie. And that's a huge deal, because otherwise you're just, you're an unknown factor. Like, I might have a great sounding idea, and I might be able to pitch it well, but who am I? I've never accomplished anything. I've never made a movie before, and that's a high risk.
And the same actually goes with video games a lot of times, because you'll hear from – and I knew, because once upon a time I wanted to make video games. Ha, 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 ha. And you'd go from panel to panel and you'd read article to article, and that's the most important thing is people – like a million and one people have ideas. Everyone's got an idea. It doesn't mean it's good. What people need to know is that you can actually produce something. And if you happen to produce something that's good, then your chances increase of being noticed even more. But the thing is, like, you're not just going to be able to say, I have this idea. And I imagine – and I've spoken with other people before. The thing about writing is that it's a basic form of communication that we're all given. So in some degree, I think a lot of people are drawn to it because it feels a bit like anyone – has the capability. Like, to bring up another movie reference, it's thinking of Ratatouille, and at the chef saying, you know, anyone can cook, and the critic realizes, you know, it's not that anyone can cook, it's that a good cook could be anyone. And yeah, I think the same technically goes for writing, is technically not anyone can write, but a lot of people do have that feeling. So having a lot of people trying to work on their big, magnificent screenplay is not surprising to me at all, because...
And it's actually, technology is getting a lot better. You can get really great cameras for really cheap. That used to be another barrier of entry, was that the equipment was expensive and film was expensive, and that's becoming less the case, which is actually creating a really interesting and dynamic film market, because there are more movies being made and a lot more independent films. So you have a lot more movies vying for attention than you used to. And it's, yeah. You mentioned Birdman as like the independent wing of a Hollywood studio, because even that, like,
it's still, like, but big name actors.
Still big name actors. I'm sure the budget of that film is still particularly high. I always think of an independent film as what would be defined as a micro budget film, and micro budget is currently defined as anything less than $10 million, which sounds like an awful lot of money.
Still, like, a lot, yeah, but
it's not a lot of money in film. The Widower is a super micro budget. We ended up spending about $150,000, though there's a lot of favors called in, and I think we had some enormously talented people. So it looks like it is a lot higher budget movie than that. I think in a lot of indie films with budget constraints, you kind of see it in this, like, you see those show up because sets will feel empty, or the design work will be a little bit subpar in terms of costumes and set design. And one of the things I'm proud of with our film is that all of that stuff is really great, especially for a film at our budget level. I mean, it looks like everything looks very lived in and very real, and we did not skimp on that. We gave that its due, and that's usually the first thing that people cut budget-wise.
Interesting. I was not aware of that. I suppose it makes sense, but
yeah, I'm sure you've seen lower budget films, and it just pay attention to sets, there's a kind of empty sort of feel to sets that aren't well designed.
Well, that's the thing; it's hard to really pay attention to some lower budget films because, as I said, like, most of what you're seeing is either the big studios, independent quote unquote wings, which is still, you know, a lot of money. They got the big actors and. Or it's, you know, the kind of straight to DVD Sci-Fi Channel original that it used to clog up the shelves of Blockbuster, now clogs up the queues in Netflix. Or you have, like, the days where you had something like Christopher Nolan's Following, which, if I recall, he's actually the son of an actor.
Yeah.
So, I keep saying The Following because of the TV show. No, his first film, Following, I think it was his first one, is definitely a very low budget independent production made on a weekend.
Yeah.
But he had that in, people knew his father, therefore people could know him. And then you have, you know, way back early 90s, you have something like Clerks. But if Clerks was made today, would Kevin Smith become Kevin Smith?
Probably. I feel like there are a lot of people who are making – if Clerks were made today, it would be another film compete – like another voice kind of competing in a myriad of other voices. So it would have a lot more competition. And I think there are a lot of there's some profoundly lower budget films that I really respond well to. Primer is the other one that always comes to mind for me, which I believe had a budget of $9,000, which is insane.
Oh my.
But I think there are resources that were at work there already. Like a 9,000, like that's the stated budget, but that, you know, that's having a house already and having all the equipment already, probably, and all these kind of things that Shane Carruth had already preset. It's still like that movie. That's a great movie, and it's made on a very low budget and didn't have any famous actors in it, or at least at the time that it came out. So I think there's a lot of the problem that a lot of the Hollywood films are having right now is they're very franchise based. And when you say an independent Hollywood film, what I tend to hear these days is, oh, it's a Hollywood film that doesn't involve superheroes.
You know? Essentially. Yeah.
That's what it's, but it's still a massive budget and still filled with, A-list talent and still pretty hefty in the resources it brings to bear. The independent film scene right now, because we have a lot of stuff, VOD is on the rise, and we have so much access to content right now that there's really room for more niche projects or more unusual projects to be able to kind of find their audiences. That's kind of what we're hoping to do with The Widowers, is we want it to find its audience. That's our next goal. We want it to find the people who don't want the conventional endings and don't want the conventional kind of Hollywood twists and turns, and would rather have something that's maybe a little bit more reflective of their life experiences. And yeah.
All right, now I did go over the non-spoiler section a bit more than I wanted to cutting into the spoiler stuff. So, for those listening, if you still want to check out The Widowers, which I highly recommend you do, it is a good movie. I did enjoy it. Hence why, you know, I have Richard on my podcast. But I definitely recommend you check it out. So, if you don't want to know anything about what happens in the film's plot, then this is about when you stop listening, but you can check out, what is it, thewidowers.com?
Thewidowers.com is the way to go. We have a Facebook page. If you search for The Widowers on Facebook, you'll probably find it pretty easily there, too.
So there you go, two sources, and you'll be able to find links to iTunes, Xbox, PlayStation, and Vimeo, and soon enough they'll have Amazon, and then they'll also have Blu-ray, so any number of ways to see it.
To Google Play is...
Google Play as well.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I rented it for like $5 on the PlayStation 3 when I in order to watch it. And, I mean, that you get it for a month. You can watch it for a month, $5. It's not very expensive to see in that regard, but I imagine
it's
it would
be in high def, too.
It's high def, yeah. But I imagine you prefer people buy it. You probably get a better cut that way.
Yeah, I mean, I hope people like it enough to buy it. I'm just happy for people to see it. So do what you can and see it. My inner and outer filmmaker would very much like you to get it in high def. Spend that extra dollar, get it in high def if you're going to rent it that way, because it's we had a phenomenal DP, and she, our whole camera crew actually just kicked all sorts of ass, and it's one of the reasons the film looks so great. We just got very lucky with the talent we had behind the camera.
All right, so if you're still listening, I'm assuming that you don't care about being spoiled on this film. So, and I'm going to be honest, when I go into spoiler sections, I do not provide plot summaries or anything. So if you didn't see the movie, you're going to get lost. Because my first question does regard the ending in that, or at least part of the ending in that, and I already expressed this to you, but it just seems so kind of out of place to have what was the woman's name, not Pam, the other woman, Terry.
Yeah,
it felt so out of place for Terry to have also seen this ghostly apparition of Jake's deceased wife. I'm sorry, but it just seems so out there.
Do you think that that's what would happen? Because I, like, my personal take on that is that's like put in there, and that could be nothing. That could not be that. And I think I wanted to, I think in a lot of like that stuff is not necessarily meant to be interpreted literally, though I enjoy that people do kind of look at that and think about that in that way, and that it creates some kind of tension and like, wait, is that out there? Is that really what's going on?
Because she mentions she saw a woman with glass in her hair, and I'm like, foreshadowing? And then you see Jake's, what, like he's following her, he gets to the end of the dock, the pier or whatever, and there she is with glass in her hair. And it's like, wait a minute, how are they going to tie this together? How is this going to make sense?
It's not meant to make sense or be tied together. I'm a big fan of ambiguity, and I like giving people doorways that they can choose to go through or not go through. And I think if that is not a doorway you want to go through, then you can watch it and have a different spin on you can kind of let what Terry said slide. You can think she's referring to something else. I mean, you can question her sanity too, if you want to approach it that way. And you can look at the whole thing metaphorically. And if you're attracted to something a little bit more supernatural, then sure, you can take that on too. I like giving audiences a lot of room. That's kind of my big thing, is I want people to have their own space to kind of interpret what they're seeing on the screen and what's happening. I don't think a lot of movies give that to you, and it always frustrates me when a movie tells me exactly what's happening, and I always greatly prefer it when I'm sort of left to make a choice myself as to like what I'm supposed to feel, or how I'm supposed to interpret something.
I mean, because in the one way I actually do agree, where you have where you never find out what Charles wrote in that note that got Jake so upset. You never find out, and I actually love the idea of that, because it's like, whatever you come up with in your head is always going to be more than what anyone could have found out it was.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter what it was. Just whatever you come up with in your head is just better.
It's totally like showing – it's like a horror movie where you show the monster versus a horror movie where you don't, in some ways. If you show the monster, you're immediately limited by whatever, you know, whatever confined appearance that monster has. If you don't show the monster – then the viewer's worst imaginations take over. Funny that question is always asked in the Q&A. People are, when we do Q&A sessions for the film during the festival run, people are always asking, what's on the note? What's on the note?
And then for a perfect internet humor opportunity, you open the note and it's just a dick butt guy.
I mean, to be honest, it, because it was a set, people were putting things on that note to try to get me to break. there was a lot of necrophilia-based stuff on there. There was a lot of attempts to kind of or childish words were often written on there. But the intention of it in the film itself is that it is to let, that's another area where I want people to imagine the worst, most offensive thing they can, and
yeah,
assume it's that. And I think that also, even not knowing something sometimes agitates people in a way that makes them pay attention and draws them in. I'm not afraid to do that, as I'm sure you can gather. Like,
yeah.
I'm okay with having audiences be a little off guard.
I feel like I agree to an extent. Like, again, like with the note, I agree. And I mean, normally when people say you hide the monster, it's because of, like, you know, old tech, you know, like you see, you go back, you watch the original Alien and you're like, that costume's actually not very good. I mean, it technically is for the time period, but you could tell it's a dude walking around.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
I had a rubber suit.
Yeah, guy in a rubber suit. At the same time, you know, Cloverfield, I kind of wish they kept the monster hidden in smoke and debris instead of revealing it at the end, because it looked kind of dumb. But
yeah, it took away a lot of the power of that movie. I completely agree with that.
But I feel like there's also a level of ambiguity where you got to be careful you don't become the guy they brought on to rewrite Prometheus. Crap, I forget his name.
I haven't seen Prometheus yet either. I've been in the widower's weeds, so I've been a little bit behind on a lot of my own movie watching. But it is on my list to catch up on that.
Damon Lindelof, that's a guy that loves ambiguity and unanswered questions as well. But I feel like there's a limit you want to hit. Like, there's ambiguity is good to an extent, and then there's a point where it's just some things I feel like need a payoff. But
well, ambiguity is a tool. The way that I always look at it is, as a writer, you have a series of tools at your disposal. Exposition is a tool. You know, dialogue's a tool. Humor is a tool. There's all these different tools, and ambiguity is one of them. And it's a tool which I don't think a lot of screenwriters, particularly in Hollywood and in the mainstream, pull out of their toolbox enough. I think a lot of people pull out the exposition hammer at times, where the ambiguity screwdriver would be a more useful and appropriate tool to deploy. So yeah, you can definitely misuse anything. I completely would agree with that. I think, in general, people err on the side of refraining from utilizing ambiguity more than they should.
And I will say, I think it actually did train audiences to dislike ambiguity a lot of times, because I do remember, again, to go back to Cloverfield as an example, the first time I saw it, I actually missed the whole clip of the footage where you saw something fall into the ocean in that old videotape. But even then, you technically don't get a clear answer of where that monster thing really came from. And I remember talking to someone after I'd seen it, and I actually do really enjoy the movie for the most part. I'm a sucker for monster movies like that. But the thing that annoyed me was people would ask me, it's like, do you find out where the monster came from? And I was like, no, not really, but it's not the point of the movie. And they were like,
yeah.
I can't watch it then. They're like, I can't watch it. I need to know. And it's like, why do you need to know? It's not the point of the movie.
I always look at it like you go to a party. And if you were to go to, like, let's say you go to a big party and there's a lot of people there, you can have a good time at that party understanding maybe 10% of what actually happens at that party, meeting only a fraction of the people at that party, becoming involved in only, like, a small portion of, like, whatever kind of story or narrative is happening at that party. There could be a whole bunch of it that you just don't know, but it was there in the background, and it was all filled in. And I just think that and we have been trained. You're right. We have absolutely been trained by over-exposition. One of my least favorite movies of all time is Midnight in Paris, in a large part because of how over-the-top the exposition of that movie is. We are told, we're given the same information over and over again. Like, it's really clear this woman's not right for him, and this one is, and it's just over and over. You get so many scenes like that, and that's kind of, like, that's just not appealing to me. I'd rather go in the other direction.
That actually reminds me another thing that you made note of. The studio, or not the studio, one of the distributors, who wanted it that Pam and Jake got would get together at the end? Why was it Pam and Jake?
We met with these that's funny. Yeah, we met with these guys who were in like a Paramount offshoot, and that was a question they put forward and asked me, and it was pretty ridiculous because it shows that these people don't really absorb or read into that. Like they don't take in like what the thing is actually about, because there's no
issue. Nor context, because it's like there is nothing between those two characters that to me means, oh, they should totally get together at the end of the movie.
Oh yeah, there's no sane person would think that in their right mind. It's one of the confession scene followed by Pam's kind of extremely misguided
attempt to fill a gap in a loneliness she's feeling. Like, yeah. She is clearly feeling lonely that night.
One of my favorite reactions to that scene was from our first AD, who said when he first read that scene, he actually went, "No!" and threw the script across the room. And that made me really happy. And I love it in screenings when it starts to happen and the audience has like a kind of a visible, like, oh no, not visible, but an audible, like, like, oh God, so uncomfortable and wrong. And no.
And my roommate actually, like, he usually avoids movies that have too much content of that manner. And he saw that and he was like, I might be leaving in a few minutes, you know, because he was really enjoying the movie. Then that scene happened. He's like, I might be walking away in a few minutes. But he stuck with it because it wasn't a very long scene. But no, it is very. I mean, even as far as like uncomfortable scenes in movies go, that wasn't too far for me. But it's like I definitely recognize that you're right. It's misguided. It's completely misguided on the character of Pam's part, but I feel like that really drives, I feel like it adds a depth to Pam. I know it might sound weird to say that.
No.
But it's, I mean, you get it.
I mean, it to me, Pam is, she's written to be very much an anti-hero, like a female anti-hero character. I think you get a lot of Don Draper's, Tony Soprano's, and Walter White's, but you don't see very many women in film and TV who, you know, who are flawed but mean, but also at the same time, like somebody you kind of want to root for them to be okay. And at that point in the movie, I feel like the general audience journey with Pam, we actually shoot her, if you look at the beginning of the movie, she's shot very much like kind of like the monster in a horror movie. At the start of the film, you don't see her face right away. She's kind of shot from behind. So you, like, you see her head and she's making all these kind of surprise motions to Jonathan in the, and that one scene where Jonathan's washing his hands in the bathroom, and like she's there in the doorway all of a sudden. It is very much in the language of how you would do the jump scare in a horror film. But And that quickly, I think, dissolves into being, she's this kind of comedic character, but then you slowly start to see her pain, and her own, you kind of remember her own loss that she mentions in the video from the beginning. You kind of see her fighting with her husband, and you see this, her current husband, and you see this very, very present and visceral pain. And Jennifer Lane Williams brings so much to the role in that sense, and she's, I think in the scene right before the scene where she kind of makes a sexual move onto Jake when she's downstairs with Jonathan post the confession, I think there's a point there where my hope is that the audience really at that moment, that's where they fully come to like, okay, I get this person, I understand her, I understand her pain, I'm sympathetic to her. And then right after that, she goes and does something which is horrible and arguably, you know, illegal and truly reprehensible. You can make a case that that's pretty, like what she does is criminal. I think you can really make that case.
Yeah, I can see that actually. But that's the thing though, that scene on the stairwell that you mentioned, I remember like her, I don't know, maybe my reading of it was, you know, seeing her go through that old box of her deceased husband and that realization that she's not over him. And then, you know, when she's on the stairwell with Jonathan, even though everything she's like, there's so many meanings in her own lines in that scene because it's completely oblivious to what Jonathan just said and did. But it also feels like she's trying, like, it kind of makes you realize that the retreat isn't just for other people that have lost spouses. In a sense, it's also for her, that she is still trying to get over it and that she's trying to use this experience to do so. And she goes, you know, she goes back upstairs, she goes into Jake's room, she makes what is a poorly guided decision. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know, like, I don't know, maybe I didn't read it as being as bad as it really was. I tend to be oblivious to some things, but
totally, like your read is totally great. And actually, you have no idea how happy it makes me when you caught all that nuance on the stairwell scene, that she is talking not just to him, she's also kind of talking to herself when she has that whole speech. Like, you put a lot of thought into something and you hope that it is visible on the screen at the end of the day. You don't really have any way to know because you're so close to the material. So yeah, your read is perfectly great, and your read on and your interpretation of how good or bad what she does to Jake is also your own. Like, I don't ever want to dictate that. Like my own bias on it doesn't matter so much. Like, it's whatever an audience member thinks it is. And there's some people who go into it and they're like, oh, that was just a poor decision. And there's some people who go into it and they're like, she should be arrested. <You know? Yeah. laughs> Like, some people who are like, that woman is a criminal. And both interpretations are totally valid, I think.
Because no one is wrong, basically. But at the same time, I mean, it's just like, and that's the thing. Like, I saw that scene and it's like, Pam is still lonely. And, you know, it makes me wonder, when it comes to her marriage, is that just an attempt for her to move on? And, like, that's where the whole ambiguity, because I actually was thinking, you know, if this was in any way a studio-backed film that managed to make a profit, I can already see the inevitable ideas for, hey, you should make a sequel that does this. And that's the thing, like, I wonder if Pam will stay married to that man, or if she will eventually, like, will she ever make it work? Or will it just be a miserable marriage? Or will they split up at some point because it's not working? But that's the level of ambiguity where it's like, I don't want another movie to answer those questions.
Yeah, because you don't need to have that. Like, that's, I've had people, I've actually, there have been people who are married who see that very last scene with Pam and Bradley, which is actually the only scene in the movie where you kind of see an extended conversation between a pair of living spouses together. And there's people who see that and say it is an incredibly dark scene because of all the context and the stuff that's happened and what they know about Pam and what they know about Pam's kind of hurt. And then there's people who have interpreted that as kind of like, oh, like there's something that's like kind of functional about that particular relationship, though, even though it's flawed, they're really good for each other. And he's just kind of letting it all slide off his back. And that's what she needs at that moment. And, I think that's it. And I've had, and what I was saying before is I've had people who are within the same marriage who have had opposite opinions on that particular scene, which makes me really happy. I like that people, you know, kind of, you know, I parse through that in their own way.
Yeah. I mean, it is a very, very, like, as I said, like I didn't get to before we recorded this podcast, but I do want to sit down and watch the movie again, because I love movies where I can sit down, watch, and I can get another reading out of. And one of my big concerns too, like whenever I make friends with someone and then they decide to create something, they work on something, and it's like, oh, I like this person, but will I like what they created? And it's always a big, like, oh, God, moment of truth. And it's always such a relief when I, because that's the thing, like, as I noted in the forum when I first spoke about it, was for the longest time watching the movie, I kept on, like, seeing you pop up and was like, that guy's Harpo Marxist. And, you know, it does kind of shift how you're watching the film, but it reached the point where I'm watching it and I'm not thinking of it that way. I'm watching it as I would any other film. And I think that is probably the mark of something where you forget that someone you know was making this film and you appreciate it as it is, as the creative work.
Oh, thank you.
This is one of those things where when I praise it, I'm praising it like any other movie. And of course, as I said, like I'm not completely with you on the ambiguity, or at least as far as you go with it, but I understand. And I will say there is one thing I was very afraid of, and I from what I know of you on the forums, I was like, he's not going to go there, I'm pretty sure, and you did not. For some reason, I was so scared that Terry and Jonathan would end up getting together, and if any kind of like business person were to try and get involved, that's where I would figure they would.
And you know what? It's funny to me because that's something else that also comes up. You're not the first person who's told me I was really afraid that they'd get together. And I think part of that is because both of the actors, Jennifer Olsen and Kent Meister, are very charming people, and I think
they have great chemistry. They do.
People, when people see men and women on screen together, who have the chemistry,
yeah,
we're trained to think, oh, that's a romantic relationship. And I wonder if that is purely from that perspective. I wonder if it's just purely because we don't see that type of relationship in film. And I'm actually, one of my favorite relationships to see on film is anytime you see people who have different genders but are just friends or just connecting in totally platonic ways, because we get so much of the like, everything has to be romantic based, and it just isn't. That's not what life is like, and in my opinion,
no,
I think,
and it doesn't help too, because a lot of films end up having, you know, I mean, I tend to be somewhere, like, politically in the middle, so I don't always make the biggest sink over certain things, but, like, a lot of films you will have, like, oh, it's an action film and it does have the token female. Personally, there's a lot of films where I'd be like, they should not have a romantic subplot at all. I'd be completely fine with that. And I'm completely fine as well with movies with guys in mind, movies with women in mind. Like, I'm a fan of, like, all kinds of things in regards to diversity, but I will say I do think there's a lot of – and I've heard people discussing it too, and it's like the mentality that you need a romantic subplot because otherwise you won't grab the women's interest is the thing that I feel is really – that's what I kind of get frustrated with. And I feel like that's where yeah, you watch these movies and that's the thing. Like, it could be just like the whole ambiguity thing. Like, we're trained to think of movies going a certain way. So you're right. You see that chemistry on screen. I mean, right down to, I mean, the latest Riddick film, for example, there, Katie Sackhoff plays a lesbian character. And she keeps through that the entire film until the very end. There's some small little line or something that's basically like, oh, so she would totally bone Riddick. Well, great.
I had heard about that, and yeah, that's one of the reasons that I won't be going to that film. I won't be viewing that film because that's not – I mean, it's just – it's ridiculous. And yeah, there's nothing in The Widowers that was ever meant to be romantic, because it's not, it's just not a film that's about that. It's a film about loss. It's a film about grief. It's a film about the way that we process loss in our society. And it's not a film about love and romance.
And I think it would especially go counterintuitive to the idea that, like, how does Pam end it? And I think it's a perfect kind of third act conclusion. Like, instead of the big fight or whatever, you have the prom. And the entire idea of the prom is broken because you're like, yeah, you get it's like people forget the proms are usually kind of crappy.
And it's also,
or at least
it's like actually kind of an insane choice that's based off of those ideas, like, oh, we'll do this kind of fun romantic. I mean, it's so inappropriate.
Yeah.
That's why it's there. And it is certainly yeah, it's one of those moments where I'm wondering, like, all right, well, this is a pretty bold choice, and I'm sure some people go into that scene and are like, what is happening in this film right now? But I think it works because it totally undercuts all of that. There's nobody is connecting. Like, there's no, like, it's all a huge disaster, and as it would be, I think.
Yeah, there's basically nobody's getting along except for Charlie and the woman he dances with, where I'm still not sure who she's supposed to be, other than, like, maybe a friend, a housemaid. I don't know.
Melinda.
Melinda?
She is basically Pam's hired help to, like, make the camp run smoothly. That's why she's there in the morning. It's one of those things, I don't state it because I don't think there's a need to state it, and I think people accept that she's there, even if they don't fully understand her role.
It basically became a joke between me and my roommate. We're just sitting there, like, they start dancing, like, who is she? And it's just, but we just laugh because you're right. It doesn't really matter to the story. It doesn't matter to the film overall. That she, I mean, you could tell she's helping her. Doesn't matter why she's helping Pam. She's just there. And so for whatever reason,
it's in the backstory. It's all there. Like, it's all thought of. It's all intentional. It's all a specific and deliberate choice. So I think it's totally fine that there's no line about, oh, Melinda's the hired help. Like, you don't need that. Like, people will accept it. And I think when people come to the big crazy dance number, I think it's the last thing people might be expecting in the film. If you've gone through Jake smoking crack and then the confession scene, I think the last thing you're going to be expecting in that third act is a big old dance number.
Yeah. No, it was a wonderful third act, and I think it's actually very interesting to, if there's anything I really want to do, I want to try and deconstruct that last scene on the dock where Jake sees his deceased wife, and then try and unpack it, because on a first viewing, if I'm going to try and glean additional meaning out of it, it's going to be something along the lines of, and I wrote about it in the forum, where she's, you know, instead of seeing her walking around, he sees her under the water now, drowning, deceased, whatever, that she's under there. And it's essentially, in some ways, to me, like him kind of laying her to rest, like saying she's gone now. And the last thing he needed to do was let out that vial of rage. He needed to shove Jonathan into the water. He needed to shove them all. He needed to rip stuff up because, I mean, he's bottling everything up. That's yeah. how he's, I mean, that's all he's doing the whole time. He's bottling it all up until now he has a lot of reasons to be angry. He just found out that his wife was cheating on him. He found out that it was not that she was just cheating with him, but with his lifelong friend.
Yeah.
And that's why she died. Like, he gets something to the extent of closure, but basically it's something painful. It's something rage-inducing, and he finally has to let go. But after that, and that's the thing, like, that's why he can move on. That's where, and I feel like, again, like, just seeing that scene, like, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there that, like, says it without saying it. Like, okay, now he's moving on, but you see at the very end, everyone else just goes back to life. Terry, you get a quick glimpse where she's still seeing her deceased wife. You get to see Jonathan. Well, he just lost his friend, too, so Jonathan's not in a great spot. Charles gets his comeuppance, I guess you could say. And I've always wondered if he really is that much of a jerk or not.
The actor who played him, Bill Prouty, is the 100% opposite.
I would not doubt. Sometimes the nicest guys can play the greatest assholes. But no, I mean, I don't doubt for a second. But he does not get, you know, that money. Gus is still, and that's the thing. Like, Gus doesn't even reach a point where he's like, oh, I don't need the crack. I don't need this. No, he just goes back and you get the feeling that he's not going to move on either. And, oh my goodness, I can't believe I never remembered to mention him. And I can't remember his name now. So fitting for that's the character.
Daniel, yeah.
Daniel. This one. So fitting for the character that he's the one that's forgotten. That is probably the best character, actually, because he's the nicest guy, and yet...
And
yeah.
And Lester Green, who plays him, is tremendous and brings so much to the role. He has some of my favorite moments in the film. And I think it's also, it's just really, he does a great job, and it's such a, it's a kind of an essential character, actually. And I think people,
yeah.
It's easy to forget, but he does so much and brings so much into the film.
I really liked his execution. I liked his character that he was there. And that's the thing. I liked that the cast was a very varied group of people. The quote-unquote most normal one was Jonathan. But you also kind of realize that he's being riddled with a different kind of grief than everyone else's. But, I generally loved all that. I loved how it ended with... That's the thing, I do love that the ending is you don't always move on, kind of a thing. And moving on doesn't always take the shape you expect it, because when Jake's finally able to move on, it's not that he's going to be happier. It's the at most he has, like, if he's been bogged down by the question of why, well, he has an answer. It might not be a definitive answer, and it might not be the answer he wanted, but it's an answer. And so he's able to clean up the mess he made in the very beginning of the film and indicate that he's ready to continue with his life now.
And we have very intentionally, we have Jake at the beginning of the film breaking all these kind of hard and sharp objects, but without any sort of release of emotion. And then at the end of the film, he's kind of in that healing room breaking the couch and the stuffed animals up, and it's all these soft objects, but the actual pain is kind of coming out to the surface. He's no longer under the water. He's kind of breaking through at that point a little bit.
Actually, that's something I didn't get to pick up the first time. I did wonder, because he did seem it did seem a bit lacking in emotion as he broke the hard stuff, and they, yeah.
It's trying to find
trying to find the rage.
It's all under the you know, it's kind of like under this layer, this kind of gauze of kind of numb pain.
Excellent. Unfortunately, I do think that is about, I mean, we did go quite a bit over from what I wanted to, but, no, I mean, it was a good conversation. I'm glad to have had you on. I'm glad to have talked about your film.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it. And, we had a really good time talking to you about it.
Yeah, I hope it gets, at least some people, listening that weren't familiar with your film or weren't familiar with Gamers with Jobs. I hope it gets them to see the film, because I do think it's worth seeing. I do think it's really good. And at the very least, because I do something now for the podcast called Norwood Film Club, once it comes out on Blu-ray, I might force people to sit down and watch it. And we might discuss it again in full on this very podcast. So
I'd be 100% A-OK with that. I can bring on other people from the team if there's anybody else you want to do too. I'm always happy to do that, and I really appreciate it tremendously.
Nah, the thing with Norwood Film Club is it's basically in my apartment, so it's me and my real life friends.
Awesome.
That was the last episode was Fight Club, and now next episode, I'm sorry to the people that listen to this for video games, because next podcast episode is going to be Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is at least related to video games, but
total video game movie.
Total video game movie. I was supposed to talk about video games last week, but that episode didn't happen. So but definitely remember, go to the Widower, for those still listening, go to thewidowers.com. Or if you've already seen the movie, then be sure to spread the word and everything. And is there anything else that you like, any other websites or any projects you work on that you'd like people to go to?
If you go to thewidowers.com, make sure if you have seen the movie, we appreciate any reviews you can put on iTunes, or whatever platform you purchased it on. That actually helps a lot with the algorithms. So go ahead and rate and review the movie if you have seen it. It'll be much appreciated on my end. And my website is richardlovejoy.com. I will be having news about future projects there. I'm looking to possibly do a reboot of Adventure Quest, which we talked about earlier in the podcast at some point. And going to be, yeah, so there's stuff going on. I'll try to keep everyone posted through my website.
All right. And as usual, you can find my stuff at www.gamertag.net, where you will find I've actually been a busy little bee of a sorts, where I've been posting. I post about Infamous Second Son and how the superpowers create a sense of, you know, it's balancing the superpowers, the challenge, and how you perceive limitation from those superpowers, kind of a thing as a player. And I've also been doing a lot of articles on games writing, recently discussed kinesthetics or how a game feels, and discussed, you know, what is a power fantasy and whether a lot of games that are claimed as power fantasies really are that. Hmm. And of course, I've got youtube.com/ramblepack64. And you can also find on gamerswithjobs.com, I recently wrote an article called My Final Destination, which is about my experiences with the Smash Brothers franchise. So check out all those links. Check out all that stuff. Thank you for listening, everyone. And Richard, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, and have a good night, everyone.
Why did you sign us up for this?
You have to let your friend go, Jonathan. He's as dead as she is right now.
You don't understand. I think I killed them.
Man. Can we talk?
I really should get back.
Jake, like old times.
I'm sorry, but I don't know what you mean.